Hello and welcome to episode 430 of the official EstablishTheRun.com podcast. My name is Adam Levitan, and finally, at long last, I thought this day would never come, but it is time for the indisputable best form of fantasy, the highest stakes form of fantasy, the most intense form of fantasy. It is officially DFS, aka Daily Fantasy Sports season for this momentous and glorious occasion. I am joined by two of the best DFS players in the history of DFS by almost any metric. It is Michael Leone and Drew Dinkmeyer. Leone, good morning.
You sound very legitimately excited to be talking DFS and not season-long fantasy, unlike your draft the other night where you ended it with, this has been fun.
Yes, I am ready for DFS season. There's no doubt about it. Dink, how's it going?
It's great, man. I'm super excited. Just what? A week away now from the start of showdown season and full slate main slate classic. So I'm super pumped and ready for a big NFL DFS tournament season ahead.
Yes, we're recording this on Thursday, September 1st. We'll have the full showdown breakdown up for the Thursday night opener as part of our in-season package. Check that out. On today's show, we're going to talk about large field DFS tournaments and how to win them. Specifically, things like the Millie Maker on DraftKings tournaments where you put up a relatively little bit of money to try to win a lot while competing against enormous fields, you know, often 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 entries. Before we get into that, important announcement, our in-season player prop subscription is live on the site. I want to be very clear. This is completely separate from our fantasy subscription this season. There's just been an insane amount of people asking me about our plans for props. And I get it. Everyone's seen our record the last few years. Like, we're really, really likely to beat the books up on this, but this is also a really niche product. You have to understand exactly what's going on. Please, please, please read the full details for yourself to see if it makes sense for you. So head to the site to learn more. You can find that information article in the dropdown from Team or Betting. Also, note this podcast is brought to you by our friends at Underdog Fantasy. This ridiculous $2 million to first, $1 million second place best ball tournament still has not filled. Best way to put your knowledge to use. Best way to get ready for your home league Underdog best ball. Promo code ETR will match your first deposit up to $100. All right, boys, let's get into it here. And by the way, for this episode, I will only be responding to the moniker King GPP Bro. So thank you in advance for your cooperation there. Okay. Score I had last year, the 250K was on FanDuel. I think DraftKings is more popular. One of the reasons that we talk more in terms of DraftKings is that you're able to actually download the data on DraftKings. On FanDuel, you are not. So we can see, go back and see all this data, everything that we have done, what the field has done over the history of DraftKings, and try to figure stuff out. So Leone, why don't you talk about what kind of data we're working here on DraftKings, and then I can give some comments on how FanDuel differs a little bit.
Yeah, we looked at weeks 1 through 16 for both 2021 and 2022 and compared the top 100 teams to the field. And we looked at the average of the top 100 teams by week and the average of the field by week. So that way, the data wasn't biased by, like, sometimes they have these huge million makers with, like, you know, a million people, and then sometimes it's only 200,000. This way, it all counts the same, because that could skew the data where if that week with a million people, there was a very popular double stack, it'd be like, oh, the field's double stacking a ton. Well, it's, you got to average that out. So I'm happy with the way we put out the data. That gives us the ability to look at how frequently teams are stacking, what their cumulative and some product ownership is, and all these different wrinkles to try and find some leverage points. What are the top 100 teams doing at a higher rate than what the field is doing?
Right. So a lot of the data we're going to talk about here is for DraftKings, because that's what we have the data from. But I do think a lot of it applies to FanDuel. There are some differences. When I play on FanDuel, the biggest thing to me is I'm just thinking touchdowns, touchdowns, touchdowns. Like, all when I'm making lineups on FanDuel, it's all that goes through my mind. Touchdowns, touchdowns, touchdowns. Because unlike DraftKings, it's half PPR. DraftKings is full PPR. And unlike DraftKings, there's no bonuses for 100 yards rushing receiving and no bonuses for 300 yards passing. So touchdowns turn into such a huge part of your score. So I'm thinking, which team is likeliest to score the most touchdowns on the week? And how will they get those touchdowns? I had a really good FanDuel team, not the team that won the 250K last year, but a different team, a Bucks stack that was really good. And, you know, Bucks weren't going to be very owned. I knew they were going to be among the league leaders in likely most touchdowns scored in the week. And how do they score touchdowns? Well, I mean, man, at that point, and really all throughout the year, they were among the league leaders in pass rate over expectation, even in the red zone. And so it was just a clean Brady double, I think it was with Evans and Gronk. And it's like, oh, of course, if the Bucs score a lot of touchdowns, it's going to be Brady, Evans, Gronk. And so that's kind of how I think about FanDuel. Drew, any more differences you want to point out between DraftKings and FanDuel?
Yeah, I think in the instances that you had a lot of success, they ended up being double stacks on FanDuel. But I actually think it's less necessary to double stack on FanDuel because you're trying to find the most touchdowns possible. And at some points, like on DraftKings, for example, because of those bonuses that are tied, right? Like, let's say you have a quarterback double stack and he's just throwing for a ton of yards, like Joe Burrow, T. Higgins, Jamar Chase, they all get the bonuses. Well, if Burrow gets the bonus, that's basically another touchdown in terms of how it's in terms of scoring 3 points versus 4 points. T. Higgins and Jamar Chase get the bonus. That's half a touchdown. So they can make up for it just in pure volume and yards. And on FanDuel, you need the actual scores and touchdowns. So the bigger the field that you play, and also Adam, some of the scores that you had were in more modest size fields, but the bigger the field you play, I think the more important it is to consider how are you going to cram the most touchdowns in? And that might not be through a double stack at all times. So I think you just need to be more thoughtful. Whereas on DraftKings, it's easier to sort of just be like, oh yeah, I'll double stack the majority of these quarterbacks that are passing quarterbacks, because if they pass a lot and get the volume, I'll get there with the bonuses. I might not even need the touchdowns. On FanDuel, you got to get the touchdowns.
Leone, anything to add specifically on FanDuel? We'll get more into stacking here in a second.
No, I think Drew hit, you know, the primary points on FanDuel, which is that you just have to understand, like, the bigger game stacks are less profitable on FanDuel because you're less likely to be able to be perfect with them.
Yep. Okay. Let's go to some data we have on stacking. Now, certainly the field is stacking more than they used to and double stacking more than they used to. When we first started playing DFS, we're talking 2013, 2014, even like stacking single was like a crazy concept. Then double stacking became kind of went from a crazy concept to something that everybody was doing. Leone, do we still want to be double stacking? Is double stacking still a positive EV thing to do?
Yeah. So the field last year played double stacks, or for the last two seasons played double stacks 31% of the time. About top 100 teams were doing it 36% of the time. And so there's still positive leverage there. It's not insane. It used to be a really huge edge, like 2-1. But it's still plus EV, particularly if you just zone in at wide receiver. If you throw in two wide receivers, and even with your bring back a wide receiver, that seems to be the simplest way. If you were to just do that, you'd probably be plus EV. And I think part of that too just goes into, not to dovetail too far off this, but at the wide receiver position, it's a good position to get unique at to begin with, because it's a higher variance position. And it's a good position that you can go contrarian. So if you're stacking two wide receivers and bringing one back, you're forcing yourself to likely fade most of the chalkiest wide receivers on the week.
Yeah. What about rushing quarterbacks? I mean, I think it's pretty clear to people that when you're playing with Brady or Burrow or Carr or Rodgers, maybe not Rodgers, but you know, some of these high volume but pocket passers, you want to double. How do you handle, Drew, quarterbacks like Lamar Jackson, Jalen Hurts, Trey Lance, Kyler Murray? Are we still doubling those?
Yeah, so I think the conversation around single, double has often focused on rushers versus pocket passers, but I think there's a third component in there that you need to consider, which is the salary of the stack in total and how many players can really support, because each player that you're putting into your lineup at a specific dollar cost, you want to generate enough upside, enough ceiling to pay off that individual cost. So in the case of rushing-oriented quarterbacks, right, where they're getting a certain percentage of their fantasy production from their legs, that's not including any of the receivers, right? So if you're talking about like a Jalen Hurts with, let's say, A.J. Brown and Devonta Smith, and those guys are all like kind of above 7K, that's asking a lot of Jalen Hurts passing to support those two receivers. And that's not normally how he's going to generate his ceiling. So in that instance, you might want to back down. Now, you might get into a spot where, for example, it's Lamar Jackson and Mark Andrews, and then some cheap third option like Devin DuVernay or something steps up because Rashad Bateman's out or something like that. In DuVernay's like 3K, that might be more supportable, even though Lamar might not be a guy you typically double stack. So I think the double stack conversation needs to not only take into account what kind of passing volume and how they're going to get the fantasy production, but the salary cost of those players that you're stacking alongside them, because really that's the name of the game. You're trying to get as many points per dollar that you can jam into the lineup. And how are those points going to come from each individual quarterback? On the passers, we know that they can support those two higher end guys often. Sometimes it's difficult when the quarterback's high priced and the two receivers are high priced. But with the rushers, you need to understand that a lot of that projection you're paying for is coming from their legs that doesn't impact those receivers.
Yeah, I think that's really good points on the salary. Leon, you mentioned stacking wide receiver. Obviously, people are going to want to say, what about my wide receiver tight end stacks, Leonie? What about my wide receiver with a pass catching running back stacks? And I know we didn't necessarily filter the data out here, but there's a big difference between stacking with, say, Derrick Henry and stacking with Christian McCaffrey. So what do you think about stacking with tight ends and running backs?
Yeah, I mean, I want it to be the right players. I think the reason why we see that as not positive leverage over the last 2 years is people do it too much at running backs with the wrong types of running backs, as you know. And just to piggyback off what Drew said, the salary matters a lot too. If I have a running back that's 5K, you know, there's a better chance of him being able to hit the ceiling with an expensive quarterback stack hitting and the wide receiver also hitting. If I have an 8-9K running back, maybe Christian McCaffrey is an outlier, but it's just tougher. You need that running back to have their alpha game. And if they're having the alpha game, it's tougher for the passing stack to hit. And then at tight end, what happens sometimes is the week can be decided by one of the elite tight ends that's in a small bucket going absolutely nuclear, which might not have anything to do with the stack, or one of the cheap tight ends doing really well. And sometimes we can overforce the correlation there, but I'm still for the correlation if it works out. It's not that you should be avoiding these. It's just that if you were between two things, generally stacking with wide receiver has been more profitable.
I'll go back to you, Leonie. Can we triple stack? Because I've seen you do it in the Thunderdome, but it's very, very, very small field though. At what field size can we actually triple stack? Because again, this all goes back to how many guys can actually hit their ceiling. What field size do we need to be at to actually triple stack our quarterback?
I probably wouldn't do it in the Millie Maker unless it was an extreme example where there's injuries and there's a lot of guys that can go off and there's going to be a ton of passing in the game. I don't know the exact field size that separates, but I know the Millie Maker is too large where, and this is what people get backwards sometimes, is the correlation matters in some ways more in a small field because you have to get less things right. You don't need to be as perfect. Whereas in a large field tournament, we want the correlation because it's hard to hit the 9-person parlay. But at the same time, there is a diminishing point of returns where you just can't hit the pure nut ceiling with all the pass catchers and you might need that. So you kind of have to feel that out a bit. So for the most part, I'm out on triple stacks in really large field MME type of structures.
I even think even in mid-sized field, I wouldn't triple stack, you know, even like a 500 or 1,000 or 2,000.
I think it's
field.
Okay there.
Yeah. 1,000 was the number that came to mind for me immediately. 1,000 entry field and less, I think it's viable. Over 1,000, I think it gets really, really tough to start to generate that upside.
I think you need one pump player in there. Yes. You know, 2 years ago, I had a Watson triple stack with Cooks, Fuller, and Darren Fells. And Fells was the absolute punt tight end and ended up okay. And it worked. I had a chance. I was very close to winning the tournament. And it worked because I think Cooks went off, Fuller was fine, and Fells was a great value. That's not going to win you the Millie Maker because the Fuller was fine component you need to also go off.
It also has to be a cheap tight end or cheap running back as the third option. You're not doing it with three receivers. Like it's too value. That receiver spot is too valuable to generate the upside to be able to do it. So you can get away with doing that with a cheap tight end where the competition for what you're trying to beat in terms of that score might be like 8 points, 10 points, 12 points, or a cheap pass catching running back. That, you know, that same thing, like that's the big thing that's changed in tournaments over the years is that the running back position doesn't generate the same type of ceiling that it has in the past, in part because of all these committee situations. And so the running back score that you're having to beat isn't as big as it is, but the wide receiver scores that you have to beat are still huge. So you really got to be particular on the positions you're utilizing within a triple stack.
One thing I wanted to point out before we move on from stacking that, you know, Gary gave some feedback on some of the Millie Maker data, but we do want to think critically too each week. Like the trends are really good to keep us honest in terms of how we're playing overall, but there's going to be opportunities to do things where we get some unique leverage that still have upside, you know, so you get skinny stacks with guys that run. He even mentioned skinny stacks with a double bring back. And I'm already thinking like I have a DraftKings Rainmakers lineup week one. That is that, which is a Kyler skinny stack with Marquise Brown, coming back with Juju and Kelsey, which makes sense because Kyler's got some rushing upside to him. And if you're on DraftKings, again, with the 100-yard bonus and full PPR, Juju and Kelsey can go off while with you still surviving with Kyler over Mahomes. So thinking through those types of things, and also to keep correlation outside of your primary game stack, outside of your quarterback, you can have running back, wide receiver, wide receiver, wide receiver on secondary game stacks within your lineup.
Yeah, for sure. Mini stacks, I think, can make a lot of sense. In the tournament that I got second in, I had the Bengals stack with Mark Andrews bring back, but then I also had two guys on opposite sides of the Chargers and I believe it was Lions game.
Texans.
Yes.
Leonie. Don't forget Rex.
Yes.
When you think of touchdowns, you think of Rex Burkhead.
I was just getting so excited from Ding talking about punt tight end and all the times that I can spend $2,700 on tight end this season that I lost
how,
my mind.
How many times did you play Travis Kelce this season, Adam?
Oh, God. In cash, I would probably say zero, but we'll see what his we'll see what his price gets to. Okay. Bring back. So bring backs became kind of a trendy term. The field is doing it. For whatever reason, the field is on to bringing it back. Do we still want to bring it back, Leone, or is the field doing it at such a high rate now that it's not even that valuable? And by the way, I should mention bring it back means the other side of your stack. Just like I mentioned Burrow, T, and Jamar Chase, the bring back if they're playing the Ravens would be somebody on the Ravens, i.e. Mark Andrews. But go ahead, Leone, do we still want to bring it back?
It's a similar thing with the data where the gap is closing between the field and top 100 teams, but as of the last 2 years, there's still positive leverage here where the field was using a bring back 36% of the time. Top 100 teams did it 46% of the time. So there's actually a little bit more leverage in the bring back than there has been in the double stacking itself. And again, particularly at wide receiver, it's 29% for the field, 41% for top 100 teams. So getting contrarian at the wide receiver spot with guys that are correlated with your main stack makes a ton of sense. There's going to be, you want to think through what type of team you're stacking. So if it's a team like Tampa Bay, where they're so positive and pass right over expectation, and they're just going to lay it on all game with Brady, it's okay to not bring that back. Like, I'd still probably lean towards doing it, but it's different than other teams that really need to be pushed. Like Dallas is an up-tempo, fast-paced team, but they have a pretty neutral pass rate over expectation. So if they're blowing a team out, they're going to need to be pushed, in which case you want to play for them being pushed, which is bringing back a skill player from the other team.
Dink, how do you think about what player or what position you want to bring back on the other side? Does it matter? Is it just, hey, let me just get anybody on the other side? Or how do you think about exactly who to bring back?
Yeah, I think the data suggests that it really does matter in terms of trying to emphasize wide receivers the most, because that's what tends to speed up the game most. There are situations where, like the running back position and the tight end position, I think the pools are relatively small in terms of players that you can use on a given week. So there are times where a team just might not have the wide receiver options at price tags to bring back that I want. And that's the other thing that I think, you know, all of these conversations around generating good tournament lineups revolve around trying to figure out what the upside is necessary to win the tournament that you're playing and the number of people that you're competing against. And so that's why some of the challenges around providing content is that the different field sizes may alter strategies substantially. And in the case of the Millie Maker, you want to be thinking of like ultimate upside. And so bring backs for me, I'm thinking of not only the position largely being the wide receiver side, but I'm also thinking honestly about price point in terms of the bring back that I'm using. Generally, if I'm using a really expensive stack for my main stack, the bring back, I'm kind of looking for a mid-tier option to come back. And hopefully that's at the wide receiver position, but it might not always be with those teams. And that's why sometimes you might find like really good stacks, but the opponent has like very little to come back with that you're excited about. And that's why you need to think critically about like, okay, is there enough upside from this player or this situation? And should I bring it back? Because I think there are niche situations to not bring it back. Generally, it's better than not, but I think you want to be thinking critically about all these situations relative to the cost that you're spending at each position. Is there enough upside to generate a ceiling performance for you in the tournament?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I'll go looking for a bring back and I'm like, my God, I don't want to play any of these guys. This is all total dust. And in that case, I think it's fine not to bring it back. I don't want to take on a horrific value, but a lot of times when everything is a horrific value on their side, you also get really low ownership. So yeah. interesting conversation on bring
back. I think it's also important to know, you know, why is no one projecting well in this situation? Is it a situation where the team has very clearly used a committee at the position for a long time? It's very hard to get the volume upside to generate that ceiling. Or is it a situation where there's just a lot of unknown in terms of who the players are, because there's injuries that have shaken out and we're kind of, everybody's projecting like sort of a spread to the players that are filling in. And there's a lot of potential variance in that projection that you could find that upside. So it's always about trying to understand like what the situation is that's painting those projections in that light.
Yep. By the way, next episode, we'll be talking much deeper on projections. Hope you guys stay tuned for that. Flex strategy, I think, is different on DraftKings FanDuel. We already mentioned that DraftKings wide receiver is something like the Millie Maker is going to give us the ceiling and the volatility that I think we need for a huge field tournament. On FanDuel, I still think running back is okay just because it's so touchdown heavy. Leonie, what do you think about DraftKings versus FanDuel and what position you lean towards in the flex?
Yeah, we lean towards wide receiver in the flex on DraftKings. The field did this 48% of the time, so the field's doing it a bunch, but the top 100 teams did it 53% of the time. That kind of flows back through the stacking data that we've covered, which is if you're double stacking with a wide receiver bring back, you're more likely playing four wide receivers because you can get that one off wide receiver in a different game that hopefully goes nuts. So there's not a ton of leverage here, but it seems like more often than not, you want to be using wide receiver. And again, it's a really good position in a vacuum to go contrarian on because there's a little bit more variance. They have the weekly ceiling and there's a lot of options. So it's easier to find a lower owned guy, whereas the running back pool sometimes can be a little bit narrower in terms of who actually has legitimate upside to help you win a tournament. To your point though, on FanDuel, because we don't get the 100 yard bonuses, we don't get the full point per reception, guys can get there on touchdowns, especially some of the cheaper backs like Melvin Gordon a couple weeks, was really profitable on FanDuel, where he just breaks a long run and gets another short goal line touchdown at a really cheap price tag, lets you do whatever you want with the rest of your lineup. So I completely agree. Definitely more likely to use running back on FanDuel and the flex than I am on DraftKings.
Dink, while we're on the subject of other positions and running backs, I'm curious what you think about committees. Because normally when I'm like, listen, I'm going to play the best plays at running back and I'm going to get weird everywhere else. That's just like my default strategy. And I don't always do it. That's like my default strategy at running back. Like, I don't mind eating some chalk at running back if I think that it's good. I just, my pool of running backs for tournaments each week is not like some wild guys that are going to be 2% owned. So what do you think about running back committees? Obviously, as you mentioned, there are a ton more committees than usual right now. What about using some of these backs that project for, 10, 14 touches in something like the Millie Maker?
Yeah. So I'll break this decision down into two parts. First, the first part of the decision I think you want to make whenever you're building a lineup is like, what is the stack that I want to make? Well, how do I want to build this stack around? And what's the price of those players? Because immediately, if you're talking like a higher price stack that you're using, you're almost immediately starting to move yourself into committee type backs or split backfields or situations where a running back is taking over more of the work that isn't priced accordingly because of injury and different things like that, because you need to work down the pricing spectrum. And in those cases, I am a little bit more comfortable using those types of committee backs that might only get 14 touches and whatnot, because honestly, I think the ceiling at the running back position has come down over the past years. There's fewer backs that are true workhorse three down backs. There's fewer backs that are averaging like 10 plus carries a game and 3 plus catches a game. There's just fewer of them out there. So the number of guys that can really bury you at the position is much, much weaker than ever before. So you see winning Millie Maker lineups sometimes with like 14 points from their running back two, as if it's like, and it's a like 5-6K player. It's not blowing the field away. So I think it's easier to do on that front. And then, the second point of this in terms of the running backs that I'm looking at in terms of a committee, I want to think about like, what's the path that they actually can generate their upside? Because some of these committee backs are like the pure goal line backs. And are they cheap enough that if they fell into two touchdowns, that could be enough, even if they have no pass catching role? Or if they have the pass catching role, but none of the goal line stuff, are they cheap enough that they could get there on sort of receiving volume alone, like a 660 game with, eight carries or something like that? Is that enough to get there? And I think with these backs that get priced in the 4 to 5, 5.5K range on DraftKings, I think you can do that. On FanDuel, it's a totally different conversation. The committee backs you need to be looking at are the ones that have the goal line opportunities, because you need to fall into those touchdowns to really ascend the leaderboard.
Yeah. Go ahead, Leo.
So one of the things that when I was researching for our ceiling projections was running backs that do a little bit of everything, maybe more than a little bit of everything, but an Aaron Jones type that may be splitting with AJ Dillon. These backs have a lot more upside relative to their projections sometimes than the top end backs, because if we have a clear RB1, we're projecting that full workload, right? Like it's tough for them to get higher. And like, obviously they have a very high ceiling, but that's factored in. So if you have a back that already projects well in a committee, and that's key, like you want them to project well to start, because you don't want to, you know, get too off kilter there. But if you have that, then you start running into circumstances where game script might necessitate this back being used more. An injury to the other back, we know that volume is going to that back. And there's just little things that add up where this back actually has some kind of monster upside, you know, relative to their base projection, even if it's not super likely to hit. And your fallback is everything Drew just said, which is they might not be that bad of a play to begin with.
Yeah, I was thinking that, I mean, you know, I haven't looked at our week one projections yet, but I'm thinking that JD McKissic and Nyheim Hines can have like reasonable base projections at their price with upside for a lot more. And so those are the kind of guys on DraftKings specifically that I think are fine. Drew also mentioned how you can use some of the goal line backs too. Let's go to quarterback. I mean, when I started playing DFS a long time ago, but I mean, punting at quarterback was, when I showed up for cash and somebody didn't punt at quarterback, I was like, oh my God, what a donkey. Like, this is going to be a cakewalk. Now it's gotten a lot different. Even in cash, I've been paying up for quarterback a lot lately for a lot of the reasons that we've talked about on the season long side. The upside is higher. They're separating more. It's more predictable. In tournaments, Leone, is the punt or cheap quarterback dead?
You hate to be too extreme and say dead, but it's very difficult to match the upside of the top quarterback. So we have a situation, I talked about this in best ball with Eric Beinfor on one of the Established the Edge podcasts, but just in terms of the archetypes of players, you know, a quarterback like Matt Ryan cannot match the ceiling of Lamar Jackson, Kyler Murray, Josh Allen. And there's so many of those guys now where it's not like you're fading one or two guys hitting a huge ceiling. There's a bucket of six guys, and all of them you need to be below 30. And then if Ryan scores 22 and they score 28, you're okay. But that doesn't happen that much because there's such a gap. Whereas at other positions, wide receiver, most notably, you can have a week where Juju Smith-Schuster matches Davante Adams. Like, that's really in the range of outcomes. Like, that's much more possible than Matt Ryan matching Kyler Murray. And so this dynamic really pushes people towards taking, you know, the more predictably high ceiling at quarterback and paying up there. It's possible at some point in time, the way the salary structure changes, that could change the way people build. But right now, most weeks, I'm really aiming for a high-end quarterback. Sometimes we get the weeks where a rushing quarterback fills in. We've had those, like the week Jalen Hurts first started, Tyler Huntley last year. And then there's a little bit more juice there.
Right, exactly. We're not talking about mispriced quarterbacks. Obviously, the quarterbacks that are cheap, if Tyler Huntley comes in at 5,200, of course, he's going to be a good play. We're talking about guys who are properly priced, but lower down there for sure. Okay. I think the next big thing in DFS tournaments is going to be people talking about product ownership. I think this is going to be the next wave. And let me explain what I mean here. Two lineups can have the exact same cumulative ownership, some ownership. So let's say you had a lineup with six guys. Let's say your lineup was only six people. You had six guys at 20%. That's the same as another lineup that has two guys at 40% and four guys at 10%. However, that's the same sum ownership. So you're like, oh, whatever, it's the same. It's not the same. The second lineup, the 40-40-10-10-10-10 lineup, is way better. It has 1/4 of the product ownership. In other words, if you multiplied all those together, you would get 1/4 the product ownership of the 20 times 6. The 40-40-10-10-10-10 is much, much, much better. Leone, maybe you can explain some of the math behind why that's better. And maybe also we can talk about how many players under 10% projected owned, we should be using.
Yeah, so it's better because it's essentially saying the combinations of your players are less likely to be owned together. You know, exactly the math you pointed out. If you have two 20% players, just independent probability, the way that works, those players are going to have a 4% chance of being used in the same lineup together. Whereas if you have a 10% player and a 30% player, you know, there's a 3% chance that they're used together. And that's, we want to get more unique, and that flows through the whole lineup. And we've seen that the sharper teams that perform well in the Million Maker are taking advantage of this, because their sum ownership is actually the same as the field's sum ownership, like almost identical. So first glance, you would think there's nothing there. But then when you look at the sum product ownership, the top 100 teams is like half of what the field is doing. So it's a really good way to get unique without sacrificing too much in terms of projection.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody's going to start talking about this soon. Dink, do you go out of your way to lower cumulative ownership? Are you looking for a certain number of players under 10%? How are you thinking about getting unique and leverage in terms of ownership?
Yeah, so generally when I'm working through these large field MME entry sets that I'm putting together, you know, hundreds of lineups using an optimizer, I have two settings for that. One, I have a cumulative ownership range that I usually set. And I will say this varies week by week. There's not like a specific number that I stick to. I would say the range is somewhere between like 95 and 135 in terms of ownership. But it varies week by week, because some weeks there might be a cheap fill-in back that's going to be projected for 40% owned, but they're a great play. And I'm going to allow my cumulative ownership to be higher. But the setting that I always have is at least one player projected for under 10% ownership. And honestly, I am considering strongly, based on the data, moving that to two, because the average lineup had 2.5 in the top 100. And I really think this is the key. You really want to have points of differentiation in your lineup that are very clear. Because every lineup, when you kind of look at it, you know, the first thing you'll say is like, okay, if my stack hits, right? But what if your stack is all chalky guys? Then you're not separating that way. So then your points of differentiating are if this sub 10% play hits, and if this other sub 10% play hits, now we're cooking. And I think that's the key, is making sure that you have those sub 10% plays in your lineups.
Yeah, 100%. And by the way, Dink mentioned some of the data there. If you go to the site, the article is up, you can find much, much more of the data behind this and much more points that we're not making on here, even though it sounds like we're already talking about a lot. Last point I wanted to make here before we jump off is this D/ST scoring. I just find it funny every year, Leone, that the field is like literally incompetent, and everybody is literally incompetent at picking D/ST. Like every year is the same. There's almost no correlation between ownership at DST and actual scoring. It's just so wildly unpredictable. How do we know if someone returns an interception for a touchdown, returns a kickoff for a touchdown? I think there's ways that we can get it in good in cash just by trying to get teams that are cheap and have a good path towards generating pressure on the quarterback and generating sacks. But for tournaments, it's just so wild out there. What should we be doing at D/ST? And are you as amazed as me about how bad people are, and really all of us are, picking D/ST for tournaments every week?
Yeah, it's really bad on the whole. The ownership correlation to DST points is 0.165, which basically means the ownership is, if you look at the R squared there, it's less than 3%. So the variance in scoring for DSTs, only 3% of that variance is explained by the ownership, which is really low. At every other position, the correlation is 0.427. So you're talking like at least 16% of the variance being explained by ownership. Now, it's possible that if you were to narrow it down to just the defensive teams, you know, are using more frequently, that maybe there's a little bit more signal there. But overall, what we're seeing is it's just such a volatile position that you really want to get unique here. And at times, whenever the chalk D hits, it's painful and it hurts. But this is just the easiest way to get unique. And the other thing too is the scoring returns can get so outsized at DST if you get a weird run out. I mean, you can outscore the chalk D by 12 points with a cheaper defense, and it's just such an edge over the field. Whereas if you get buried by the chalk defense, it kind of, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to spend down so much at defense, and I get in spots where I spend down that sometimes you just run into popular defenses. I think spending up, especially on DraftKings where the salary cap is tighter, is going to just lean you to be more unique anyways. Drew, any comments on D/ST?
I just cannot believe the data keeps showing this, because my human emotions only remember every time the chalk D scores like 20 points and I'm just tilting my face off that I'm buried by some like Patriots defense at 4,200 generating 20 points or whatever. Yeah. Like, But the data is the data. And obviously, like, I've been playing, you know, tournaments for a while and trying to get contrarian at defense. And there's nothing more frustrating than the chalk defense is hitting. But they don't hit as frequently as it feels like they do, just because it is the most frustrating thing in DFS.
Yep. All right. We've said it all on tournaments. Actually, we haven't said it all. For more on this, go to the article. There's a lot more out there in the article on the site. It is free if you guys want to check that out. On the next episode, I think you guys will find really interesting. We're going to hit more on projections, how we make them, what goes into them, give a taste of kind of where we're most accurate and how we do it all. Stay tuned for that next episode as we continue to get ready for DFS season, aka the best season. For Drew, for Leonie, for producer Luke, I am your humble King GPP bro. Good luck, everybody.